This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. Safe at Home is a series of photos capturing life for people at home around the world during this pandemic. All of the images are taken remotely by Kathleen Greeson, an award-winning photographer from her home here in the Chattanooga area.
Kathleen, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
How did this project begin?
Well, I am a professional documentary photographer, and one of my recent projects I was working on was actually documenting my brother who had attempted suicide, and I had been chronicling his return to life. And when COVID happened and everything was shut down, I was thinking about how I could continue to document him and his progress. And one day we were FaceTiming and I made a screenshot of him over FaceTime, and it dawned on me that maybe I could document other people like that too during this time.
How did you reach out to people to get them involved?
Well, it started with just friends and family, close friends and family, and then it just took off, mostly social media, which is the modern day word of mouth. I reached out to a friend of mine that had moved from Chattanooga. He was a missionary in Italy, and I knew he was living there during their extreme lockdown. So I reached out to him, and he helped me photograph a lot of people there. And then from there, it just turned into more. So at this point, I have documented people from almost every point on the globe.
And you have documented people working remotely. You have documented people where they are remotely.
Yes, exactly. Wherever they are sheltering during COVID, that's where I have documented them.
You mentioned FaceTime. How have you been doing this work?
Several different ways, but I've been connecting with people on either FaceTime or Zoom or Facebook Messenger, or for my international shoots, it's been through WhatsApp. And then I direct the people where to put the phone or the tablet or the computer, and then I take a screenshot on my end.
How much of an idea do you have when you approach a new subject of what you're going to take for the photo?
It just kind of depends on who it is. Sometimes we have a conversation ahead of time, and a lot of people have something specific they'd like to be documented about their lives during this time. So we'll set up the shoot for whenever they're doing that. Sometimes people just ring in and we just photograph them doing whatever they're doing right at that moment. Some of it's planned and thought out, and then some of it is just as they are.
There's a lot to be said about the moments that are impromptu and random.
Yes. Well, those are my favorite moments. As a former photojournalist, and I still consider myself a photojournalist, I like to capture things in the moment as they are. So that has been sort of a challenge when you're planning through FaceTime to get that. But that's where the pre-planning came in and the conversations ahead of time. But yes, and the most amazing part is that no matter where you are in the world, we were all having this shared experience. It looks the same in Italy to South Africa to Guatemala to my back porch in Tennessee. We were all just staying home.
What are some of the recurring themes that you have noticed in taking all these photos?
Family, just kind of a simple life, a simple taking pleasure in the simple pleasures of life, family time. A lot of people wanted to be photographed with their pets. Not a lot of people wanted to be photographed working from home, even though that's what a lot of us are doing. I would say mostly family.
And then how many are you taking a day? How many are you taking a week at this point?
At this point, I'm doing 3 or 4 a week, but sort of when it first started and when it really got rolling, I was doing 3, 4, 5, even had a day where I did 10 every day. I took a break. My mom had to have unexpected heart surgery, so I took a little break, but now I'm getting cranked back up again. Like you were saying, and like I'm still doing, a lot of folks are still at home. So this has not gone away. It's continuing.
How has this work shifted for you as it has continued? There's a difference between you're just getting this project started and it's the first few weeks or maybe the first month or so of this pandemic, but now we're several months into this.
In the beginning, it was just a lot of people in their homes. And then I started to get more specific with what I was looking for, you know, maybe something I hadn't documented yet. And I would try to think about how I could incorporate that and trying to show the different ways that being at home affects people. And one of the number one things I heard along the way was, wow, I'm so glad to see that everybody else is doing what I'm doing. One person said, I feel a lot less alone just looking at these other photos of people staying home. So it's similar now to when I started it. People are still at home, and a lot of places in the world are still a lot more locked down than we are here in the U.S.
What are some other messages that you are gleaning from these photos as you take them?
Well, for me personally, I didn't realize how much I needed to connect with people during this time until I kind of got a little ways into this project. But it's been really good for me. And the thing that I probably in my whole 20-year career have never worked on a project that was so universal, where we were all, no matter where you are in the world, we were all having the same experience.
And where can people go online to see these photos? Where can people go online to reach out to you if they want to participate?
Well, right now the project is on my website. It's KathleenGreeson.com. My email, my phone number, my Instagram, everything is on my website. So you can find me there, and I'm including more people every day. So that'd be great.
All right. Kathleen, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a pleasure.
With school set to resume in the Chattanooga area, childcare providers face new challenges. Katie Harbison is president of Chambliss Center for Children.
Katie, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us how Chambliss is operating at this time, several months into the pandemic, and as schools are about to return in some form or another.
Yes, it's certainly been the roller coaster of a ride. We closed down in March to only serve children of essential workers in our child care program. In May, we opened back to everybody who was previously enrolled with a lot of new procedures in place. So we're now taking temperatures at temperature check-in stations. All adults and children age 5 and over are wearing masks every day. We're hand washing every 30 minutes. We do not allow shoes in classrooms. There's a lot of additional cleaning going on. So it's a new normal. I think we're going to be here for a while, but we have not seen all of our children coming back, which has been interesting. I'm not sure what we were expecting. We didn't know what to expect, but only about 30 to 40% of our children have come back. So we're running at lower numbers right now, which is actually a kind of a good thing, because then we have plenty of staff to do things like temperature checks and extra cleaning. So that's been kind of nice. But our biggest challenge, or I guess our biggest thing on our mind right now, is what's going to happen with the school system and what that means for school-age children, and then how we respond to that.
What are you hearing from parents?
I think a lot of our parents are concerned, rightfully so, about the pandemic. A lot of them are fearful of children going back into a childcare setting, especially into a building as large as ours with lots of children and lots of staff. So I think there's a lot of fear, and there's just a lot of uncertainty about how this is affecting their children, not just from a academic standpoint, but also from a social emotional standpoint. So I know a lot of parents are really struggling with, do we send our children back to school because we think that's what they need? But then is that risking their health to do that? So I think there's a lot of unknowns and there's a lot of fear. And I think that's really the main feeling we've been getting from parents.
And then how are you and your colleagues handling all this?
We've gotten used to this new normal of some of us working remotely, some of us being in the office. Our teachers in our early childhood program have done an amazing job of adapting to all of these new masking and hand washing procedures. And we have had a few cases of COVID within our early childhood staff, but those have all come from exposure outside of the agency. So they've been with a family member or a friend who's had it. The nice thing, and the thing I've commended our staff on, is that we haven't passed it within the agency, which I think is really all we can hope for at this point. We can't stop community transmission. We can't keep people from being with their families, and I can't force people to wear masks when they leave the campus. So the best we can really hope for at this point is that we don't start spreading it between staff members on campus while they're working. And so far, we've been able to do that. So I think we've done a really good job of keeping up with the procedures and being really diligent about mask wearing and hand washing.
And of course, certain populations have been affected particularly hard, a lot harder than others. Talk to me about that in terms of the work that you and your colleagues do.
Yes, you're exactly right. We primarily serve an African-American population, and we know from statistics and also just from our own personal experience that we have seen a disproportionately high number of COVID positive cases in the African-American community when you compare that to their percentage of the population. And there are also studies, statewide studies, that show that in general, the African-American community is also more cautious and potentially even fearful of the virus, rightfully so. So I think we have seen that when we had our very first case of COVID on campus from a staff member. I'll tell you, there was some panic and people very scared and upset. And I think a lot of staff members thought that it would never come here because this was their safe place. And this is a place they spent a lot of time, and a lot of our staff have worked there for many, many years and feel a real comfort and safety in that environment. So it was a little unsettling for people when we had our first case. But I think everybody has realized that, again, we can't prevent it from spreading through the community, and therefore we know staff members will be positive. But there is certainly a healthy dose of caution and fear surrounding that.
What are some of the things that you and your colleagues are just going to be looking for to keep yourselves safe, to keep everybody that you're interacting with and caring for safe in the next few weeks?
I think our big focus in the next few weeks, programmatic-wise and safety-wise, is really what's going to be happening with the schools. We are also trying to figure out how we can serve children whose parents have chosen option one or option two for them. And so trying to figure out how we set up classrooms to possibly have some children who are there all day doing their online school, and then to also have classrooms where we have children who are going to school a few days a week and who are only there 3 days a week. And how do we prevent those children from mixing so that the exposure remains low? Obviously, if a parent chose option two, which is the at-home, HCS at-home option, then they're concerned about the safety of their child. So we would not then want to mix a child who's doing the HCS at-home option with a child who's doing option one, which is the phased option. So there's just a lot of very challenging logistics to figure out how do we serve as many parents and children as possible, because we know there are so many families out there that are going to need support in this childcare world when they are trying to work and their children are going to school or maybe not going to school. How do we do that and balance the safety of the children and staff that we'll have there every day? So that's what we're working on now. And that's our main focus.
And meantime, if people want more information, where can they go online? Where can they call?
ChambliscCenter.org is our website. Our main phone number is 423-698-2456. We post volunteer opportunities on iHelpChattanooga.org, and we've had several of those lately that are mainly outside or in areas where children are not present, just to keep people safe. So we'd love to have volunteers and help in that way too.
All right, Katie, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Twice a week online, the Bessie Smith Cultural Center here in Chattanooga features community members reading children's books to spur dialogue on race relations. The digital series is called Bessie's Front Porch, and yesterday, Candy Johnson, senior advisor to Chattanooga Mayor Andy Burke, read Vote by Eileen Crislow. Here's part of that reading.
Vote for Bill Brown for mayor. Vote for Chris Smith for mayor. Who will it be? Suppose your town is about to choose a new mayor. How will you do it? You'll vote. Elmer says, "What are we doing here?" Sparky says, "This is a rally. We're asking people to vote for Chris for mayor." "I'm Chris Smith, candidate for mayor. I hope you'll vote for me." "Do you see Chris?" "Those people want to vote for Bill Brown," says this dog here. "Vote? What is that?" Voting is a way to choose. You can vote for your favorite books, movie stars, candy bars, or even puppies. How the Chris Smith family voted for their dog, Elmer, 8 years ago. When I was a puppy at the dog pound, the Smiths came along looking for a puppy. They couldn't decide between me and a poodle, so they voted. Dad picture here says, I vote for Mutt. The mayoral candidate, Chris Smith, the mother says, no, the poodle. Vote for the poodle, Angela. And Angela pointed to Mutt. But they couldn't have flipped a coin. Couldn't they have flipped a coin? Heads, the Mutt. Tails, the poodle. Tails for poodle. That's not fair. Why not? Because two people wanted me. Only one wanted the poodle. Well, can't you tell all the people all the time? But I think I've grown on her. Voting was the way to find out what the most people wanted. Does that mean one person didn't like you? So if Chris gets the most votes, she'll be mayor. What does the mayor do? The mayor is the leader of our city. Let's go help Chris find some votes. These are the two dogs talking. If anyone wants to be elected mayor, she needs to convince as many people as possible to vote for her. You have my vote, as you see the gentleman talking to the mayoral candidate, Chris. I'm going to vote for Brown. That's another opinion. Grr, growl. You can't vote for Brown, says the dog. Sparky, stop that. This country is a democracy. That means people have a right to vote for whoever they want. That's what a democracy is.
Watch the entire readings from Bessie's Front Porch on the Facebook page and YouTube channel for the Bessie Smith Cultural Center. New readings appear online at 11 a.m. on Tuesdays and Thursdays. You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment.
This is Scenic Roots, talking writing. Good afternoon. Our guests this afternoon are poet and songwriter Charlotte June and poet and fiction writer Kate Landers, who is also the vice president of the Chattanooga Writers Guild.
This is a song that's about sinkholes and romance, which are important things where I come from. Something out of the night sky. I'm waiting to fall into the water with you. The cold will hold us up. The blue will work its wild and wonderful voodoo. When you're alone sometimes, think about me, wonder where we'd be if we stayed in the water. You dreamed about a mountain, I dreamed about a stone. You told me to hold you to your through the lion's gate. When you're alone, sometimes
All right. Thanks, Charlotte June. So I was going to read something that they quoted you online. I think maybe you wrote it, Charlotte, because it's written in the first person. It says, I'm Charlotte June, and for many, many years, I worked passionately as a musician, writer, and teacher in various capacities. Then during one stunning and surprising year, I became a parent, and my journey changed. And I wondered if, you know, since you're both parents, if that's true for both of you, did that have a big impact on your life too, Kate, when you had children?
I think it's one thing to have a child. That was a surprise, which my first was a surprise for me too.
It wasn't planned.
Nope.
But you knew basically how these things happen, right?
I mean, you know, I guess there was a chance, but I don't know, when you've never been pregnant before, you're like, that can't happen to me. Like, that's something that other people do, but it happened to me.
That's so true, isn't it? I know exactly what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah, it's always the, you know, other people who have their lives together and are planning for this. But nope.
In my case, it really was something that was not likely at all. And when I was in the hospital delivering, these young nurses kept coming in and looking at me. And I was like, finally, I was like, hey. Why are you looking at me? Is it because I'm the oldest mom you've ever seen? And they were like, yeah.
I guess if you ask a question like that, and nurses tend to be kind of blunt anyway about that kind of thing, don't they?
Indeed. I was not in the least offended because, you know, no one was more surprised than we were, so.
Well, that's kind of interesting then to put your perspective with Kate's. I don't know how old you were when you became pregnant, Kay, but I'm assuming you were relatively young, right?
I became pregnant when I was 26. Yes, I was still pregnant. I don't know the math. 25, 26. No, we just weren't planning it.
I love the British expression, I fell pregnant. So, like, I love that expression. It's so, like, oh, I wonder how that, I was just walking along.
It's a very poetic way to put it, though, don't you think?
Indeed. Yeah.
So the question is kind of hanging in the air. Is it possible to plan a pregnancy? You know, it seems like...
Oh, I know people that have, and they're like...
And it doesn't happen, right?
I know people that it's all unpacked exactly the way they planned it.
Wow. Yeah.
When I planned my second child, and yeah, we just, you know, got down to business, and I fell pregnant very quickly.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't meet my husband until we were in our 40s. So, you know, in the beginning, we weren't trying to and we weren't trying not to. But after nothing happened for a really long time, I think we were operating under the assumption that...
This probably wouldn't.
Yes. It was a false assumption.
Apparently. And also a false assumption that apparently that it's problematic for a woman past 40 to have children, right? Don't they say that?
Oh, at 35, you go on the high risk.
Oh, yeah. I was with the advanced maternal age doctor, for sure. Yeah, I mean, I do think there are a lot of risks. I just think we were very lucky. And we count her as sort of our little fairy child who just, you know. I know when I met her, I was like, oh, you're the one. You're the one that I haven't met yet.
Huh. So. That's exactly what my wife said about her son.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Oh, I've known you.
I knew you were missing. You were something was missing. Huh. Hey, you, I know you. Yeah.
And completely changed your life the minute she came in, huh?
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, musician. It was a really big change. I know people. I mean, I know musicians that just take their babies out on the road with them, but I'm just not that person. I'm not organized enough. Mentally organized enough to do that. It would be a disaster for everyone involved.
I guess you have to make a decision about whether that's a good idea anyway, right? To have your children in that kind of situation. How do you feel about that, Kate? Because the impression I have, and I have to tell you, you win the prize for brevity in terms of what's available when one Googles you. Kate Landers grew up in the suburbs of Houston, but now lives in Chattanooga, Tennessee. She really likes clickety keyboards, iced coffee, and other people's dogs. That's it. That's so all true. I could find. And I'm thinking, but I know more about Kate than that. But I don't know where I found it because I couldn't find it again.
I think you found it on my website, which my husband set up after the last time I was on here. And you asked, where can we find more of your stuff? And I had to say nowhere. So my husband set that up, and that is the bio that I put on the page. And that is all.
That's pretty sneaky. Okay. Well, I don't blame you. My brother spent his life building computer networks and working with computers. If you Google that man, there is not a sentence about him on the web.
Because which, he's clever in these enough days, to erase his footprint.
Yeah.
It's a choice you have to make, like how much of yourself you want to put out there mm-hmm. for people and how much you have to keep to yourself. And
I am so glad that there was none of this when I was in my 20s. It would have been mortifying. My 20s were a very wild, improper time.
But this is supposed to be.
I think so,
that's when
too.
You're figuring it all out, isn't it?
I think so, too. And I'm so sad that now people have to feel like you make one drunken mistake and you could become a meme.
Yeah.
There was a headline on an article yesterday, the psychological and emotional impact of spending time on social media. And the more time you spend on social media, the more likely it is that you are emotionally and physically affected by it.
Right.
And probably not in a good way.
Yeah. We react to being actually in the physical presence of other humans. I mean, I think there's this sort of vibrational thing. It's the same thing we see with music. And I can see it, I teach Music Together, which is a early childhood music program, and you can see it in littles. They react to that, the presence of music in the room, voices in the room. It's a completely different experience than what you get from them when they just hear background music kind of going on. Sort of need that vibrational, there's something powerful and human about it that makes us feel connected and like we belong. And I don't know that you can really get that via social media. I grew up about 7 hours east of New Orleans. So I went to New Orleans a lot in my early musical life.
That's an education.
There was a lot of New Orleans. And so I love New Orleans horn bands, and I've heard a lot of New Orleans horn bands. But I had never heard a New Orleans horn band in a tiny, tiny venue. And one New Year's Eve we went and we saw Rebirth and Soul Rebels were playing at the Treme, which is like this little, it's basically where all of them cut their teeth, right? It's where all the young horn players play. So it was like the great big homecoming, it was a massive party in this tiny, tiny room. And the feeling of those horns, that air, it was so powerful. Like there wasn't a still foot. You can't not dance. It's like it's physically impossible to resist dancing in that environment.
And I think, New Orleans is an education in how organic music works, right? This is not showbiz music at all. This is music made by people that you have the feeling. Well, it's not a feeling.
It's food.
You just walk down a residential street, what appears to be a residential street anyway, and all of a sudden there's a club and there's all these musicians piling out of the place, in what appears to be, just a regular residential neighborhood. So you are, at this point, a musician or not?
You mean, am I a professional musician?
No, when you were in New Orleans the first time.
Oh, yeah,
So were you playing at that point?
Yes, oh, yes.
I read another article talking about it's not just the notes that are played, but it's the feeling that's around those notes. And that's what you need to connect with. That's what brings you to inside the music,
That's what it makes me think about musicians that everyone knows of as a musician's musician. You'll hear people say that, oh, he's a musician's musician, right? He may not have, the greater populace may not have even heard of this person, but you can start pulling musicians and say, oh, do you know this person? And everyone's like, oh, yeah, and I think it's that awareness of craft, maybe, and
I think so.
Which makes me think of writing. So I'd love to hear some of your craft.
Thank you for that, Charlotte. That's a really cool way of making that transition.
I did. I was like, oh, craft. Writing is a craft, too.
Let me tell you, Kate has been recognized and has won awards as a fiction writer, as a poet, and also, and I think in some ways this may be the most challenging, she also has written for children.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if it helps to have written poetry to write for children.
It just depends on how, if I just want to be silly or if I am trying to say something. It depends on how much Dr. Seuss and Jill Silverstein I've been reading lately.
Has a huge influence.
Yeah.
It just seems to me that, you know, if you're writing for children, first of all, you have to scale it down. I'm not going to go with dumb it down because that's the worst thing you can do. But you do have to scale down the language, don't you? And yet at the same time, you want to communicate the same ideas that you would communicate to adults, but in a way that they can, because presumably their experience isn't as broad, your frame of references becomes narrower, and their vocabulary is perhaps not as broad as an adult either. So you have to be aware of that too, right?
Yes, I have received much feedback about my vocabulary because I just feel when you land on the right word for something, I just want to use it, and I'm just stubborn, and I don't want to change. So I just, whatever, I'll just move on from that person. But honestly, when I write children's literature, I write for the parents of the children because I have been reading children's books for over 10 years, and I have read so many, yes, so many bad children's books that I'm like, this one is going to be a craft next week. We're just going to cut this up and make it into something, and I am never reading this book again. So as much as I enjoy writing children's literature, I never write to the child because I know that they're not going to buy the book. The parent is, and the parent is going to read it. So this is for all
you. That's the shrewd marketer in you. But at the same time, and I think what you wanted to avoid, because it drives me up the wall, is that voice. When we were children, there was a woman who'd come on the radio in the afternoon. She'd say, "Are you sitting comfortably? Then I'll begin." And she talks like that the whole time, you know, in short staccato sentences with this, you know, honey dripping from her tongue voice. It's like, you know, give me a break. You know, children are not from another planet. They've got the same feelings and emotions as the rest of us. I mean,
they also have really, really well-developed BS detectors.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a real challenge, right?
I mean, they do. And they can spot hypocrisy. Like, it's like they sort of, they know, like, if something looks a way on the surface, but it's vibrating as something different underneath the surface, they can't tell you. They can't put it into words, but watch
them. They know it.
They know.
Yeah.
I mean, I wish my kids were more gullible. Like, I've raised two very cynical children, and I can't get away with anything.
That's the sign of a good educator, though. If your student, I used to say that, they'd be like, "Your kids are so skeptical." And I'm like, "Yes!"
But sometimes you want them to just believe in whatever it is you're trying to get them to believe. You know, whether it's just like, "Yes, honey, there really is a toy troll is what we have in my house." You know, toy troll comes and he's going to take all your stuff if you don't put it away. Yeah.
How old are your children?
10 and 4.
And the 4-year-old doesn't buy the toy troll thing?
I don't enforce it as well as I should. I don't invite the toy troll over as often as I should. So I think she is starting
She sussed it that there's holes in this toy troll story, huh?
Yeah, but she's going to be listening to this. So.
You can edit that part out.
Stum, I hear. So are you going to read a children's story right now or something you wrote for adults?
I just brought stuff for adults today. The first thing I'm going to read. I'm a member of the Chattanooga Writers Guild, and we have a spring contest every year. And I wrote this for the contest. It did not win. But I still really believe in this story, so I'm going to read it.
Yes. Win Schmin.
Yeah. You know, I'm not in it for the money, okay?
That's
it's
right.
For the love of the craft. So I'm just going to read just the beginning of it. And I call it Earth 10. By the time the universe ended again, the planet Earth had already been blown up by its own star for almost 500 million years. Those who worked in the Earth department, considered seasonal employees, were always terribly bored as they waited tables or worked retail jobs for the 500 million-ish years it took for the universe to restart. Needless to say, there was an electric tingle of excitement in the air as everyone gathered into the boardroom for the kickoff meeting. Earth had only been approved through the finance department 9 universes ago, and there were still quite a few kinks to work out. Everyone had spent the off-season brainstorming improvements and was more than ready to share their ideas. Thankfully, someone had remembered to bring pastries and plug in the coffee pot this time. At the last planning session, there had been no refreshments, and the employees had quickly become disgruntled. Coworkers huffed phrases like, "not my job description," while simultaneously accusing one another of not pulling their own weight. It almost came to blows until someone smartly suggested they blame everything on Janine. Everyone agreed, and after that, things settled down. Still, the meeting had started off on shaky ground, and Earth 9 had suffered. The planet had been condemned and the whole solar system quarantined. It was quite the embarrassing fiasco, and the Earth Department was determined to rebuild its reputation. Today, Janine was standing by the coffee pot, making sure everyone who entered the room knew there was fresh coffee and mini bagels available, even though she had had nothing to do with bringing them to the meeting. A few folks muttered, "thanks, Janine," as they tore open sugar packets or plucked a butter pat from the bowl. Janine smiled modestly, accepting their misplaced appreciation, while at the same time not lying, exactly. Finally, the lights began to flicker and the small talk died down, to the relief of all the introverts. Everyone turned their attention to the front of the room, where a figure in a sharp navy pinstripe suit now stood. He called himself BPHD, which stood for Ballpark Hot Dog, his favorite food. The ballpark hot dog had been invented in a happy accident during Earth 4 after an intern in the mammals department had mistakenly been included in an edible things department email. Ballpark hot dogs had been a staple in all versions of Earth since. "Good to see everyone," said BPHD. "I know you all have some terrific ideas for Earth 10, and I look forward to hearing them all. So who wants to go first? Sudafed?" Sudafed rose, tucking her long blonde hair behind one ear. When she spoke, her voice was high and clear, like an echo at the apex of Mount Everest. "I feel like there's always too many bugs," she said, and several people in the room nodded in agreement. "Even after we introduce reptiles and fish and birds, there are still way too many bugs. I mean, in Earth 9, we had multiple ice ages, several floods, and the humans got the whole place condemned, but there were still too many bugs." BPHD rubbed his chin thoughtfully. "But the way we've always set it up, bugs are a staple of every ecosystem on Earth. Without bugs, life wouldn't be possible." "I don't care. They're icky," BPHD sighed. "And how many bugs would be acceptable for Earth 10, do you think?"
"Like 5?
5 species?
"No, just 5.
"Thank you, Sudafed. Next. I have some ideas." "Ugh. No, Janine, but thanks. But next!" A small furry creature with large yellow eyes stood up.
"I have a proposal," it squeaked, and half the room said, "aww."
Then it hiccuped, and the other half of the room blessed its little heart. BPHD smiled warmly. "Yes, Mr. Snugglekins?"
"Last time, too many people from other worlds showed up, and we ran out of food. It was kind of a bummer."
"Yes, I recall." Mr. Snugglekins wrinkled his nose cutely.
"So I was thinking this time we could avoid that problem if we just made everything edible."
BPHD frowned. "So you want to make food out of rocks and dirt?"
"No, no, no, silly head," said Mr. Snugglekins. "I'm saying let's do away with all that yucky inedible nature stuff, blech, and just make the whole world out of lollipops and cotton candy fluff and chocolate ice cream."
He spun around in circles as the room gave him a standing ovation. BPHD pretended to write this idea on his clipboard as he waited for the applause to die down. "That is definitely something to think about for Earth 10. Thank you, Mr. Snugglekins. But what if instead we just asked everyone to RSVP and then put a cap on how many people could be there at a time?"
Mr. Snugglekins giggled and shook his head. That's so lame. Who would want to come to a party like that?
Well, we're not really planning a party. This is work, BPHD said.
Mr. Snugglekins shrugged. I guess that's why you're the boss man, boss man.
He sat down and whispered something to the sacred cow beside him, and then they both looked at BPHD and giggled. BPHD straightened his sleeve cuffs and searched the room. Who else has an idea?
I do. Anyone besides Janine?
Yes, Cadillac Jack? I don't really have any ideas, but I wanted to let everyone know that the Black Hole Committee said it'll be conducting a test flush in our galaxy this time, so if we don't want the Earth to get sucked in, we need to make sure it's securely fastened. This time, BPHD really did make a note. Got it. Thanks, CJ. Anyone else?
I'm standing right here with my hand raised, as you can clearly see. When you learn how to plug in a coffee pot, then we'll talk. Who else has an idea?
An ethereal wisp floated out of its chair and began to radiate love. The people sitting around it gently placed their coffee mugs in their laps, looked up at the wisp, and sighed blissfully.
I have a suggestion, the wisp whispered.
Kate Landers, our guest, and I think if that story illustrates anything, the line between children's fiction, so-called, and adult fiction's pretty fine. I can imagine kids really enjoy that. Well, I'm thinking that I should ask you the same question, Charlotte, because you work with children all the time. So has that changed the way you write because you're working with children?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Yes, it's changed the way I write if I'm writing for kids.
This is Scenic Roots, talking writing. My guests are Kate Landers, whose website is katelanders.com, and Charlotte June, whose website is charlottejune.com. To close, a song from a session Charlotte June recorded in the Chattanooga Downtown Library a couple of weeks after we recorded this conversation in August last year.
Experience.
Deep into that one.
Charlotte June with her friend Jade playing bass and adding a harmony, recorded in the Chattanooga Downtown Library in the fall of last year. This is Scenic Roots on listener-supported public radio, WUTC. I'm Richard Winham. Thanks for listening.
I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Thanks, as always, to our producers, Haley Solomon, Carly Dodson, and Will Davis. Email us at scenicroutes423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroutes423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.